Welcome to our first edition of Children of Song. This is a podcast that explores what it must have been like to grow up surrounded with music. We're going to be talking to basically children of famous musicians and find out what it was like to grow up in that kind of atmosphere, to be inspired by the people that came backstage, who visited their homes on weekends, and what prompted them to follow in their legacies and enter into this world of music. I'm Brad Newman, the producer of this journey. We're in Nashville. We're calling this our Nashville Sessions. We're right near Belmont College. We're driving through this neighborhood. I'm with my audio tech, Jamie Pfeffer. Hey, Jamie. I am not driving by myself. I cannot speak and drive at the same time, it appears. No, we are heading over to Robert Orman's house. When we came up with this project, I was looking for the perfect host. And I had done a project in Nashville a couple years ago for Black History Month. And we had done this interesting retrospective on the great Sammy Davis Jr. And I was working with a local photographer. His name is Chris Condor, who is just a wealth of information when it comes to these parts. And he said, you cannot do this feature without Robert Orman. Well, we are off to see Robert Orman this morning. And Robert is a most interesting character. I remember very clearly that day. We had had a very long shoot in the morning. We were down in Franklin, Tennessee, and making our way back to Nashville. And for those of you who don't know it, there is a ton of traffic in this area. This is a booming city. And we had gotten up to Robert's house in the late afternoon. I think we were all a little tired. And Robert woke us up with his stories. He is a magnificent storyteller. And I said to myself, when I walked out of that house, there's going to be another project someday. Someday there's going to be a project where this gentleman and I sit down and get together and really start telling stories. And that project is this, Children of Song. Now, we are early, so I hope that'll be okay for him. Robert is a very interesting guy. He scares me just a little bit, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, actually, he's so passionate about music. When anytime I've talked to him on the phone, even leading up to this project, he always has a ton of stories to say. He writes two different columns a week. And he's written 7 books, and he was in this huge project. I think this is his house right here on the right, if I'm not mistaken. And he said he had to write 30 essays in over a 4-day stretch, and he'd asked me not to bother him. I said, okay, I'll see you when I get down there. All right, let's say hello. Beautiful out here today. First thing I noticed when I was down here, the birds are singing here. They're not singing up north. Uh-oh. Attack dog. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Toto, get back inside.
That's right, it's Toto. I remember.
Toto. In. Now.
You gotta go inside.
Come on.
She's sweet.
Are you on?
We are on a little
bit. Here's the first thing you need to know.
Okay.
It's Music City. We're surrounded by music. Okay. Across the street is Lyle Lovett's bass player. Next door is Robert Plant's band leader. 2 doors down is the manager of Blackbird Studios, which is John McBride's studio, the husband of Martina McBride, the best studio in town. And behind us is Nancy Griffith, who first popularized From a Distance, which Bette Midler later made into a big pop hit. And I could throw a rock from this porch and form a band.
All right, let's go inside. Hey, Toto. Well, thank you so much for having us in. I hope we're not too early. Or did you see us out there, Weber?
I saw you out there.
You know what I thought was most interesting? I was sitting here going through, and my instinct, you know, of course, my instinct, I think,
when I first got this project, why you were so perfect. And I was sitting here trying to go over my head, you know, was it just that interview we did about Sammy Davis? And, you know, it dawned on me that you are really a child of song as well because of your grandmother.
I am. I grew up in the music business. And that's one of the reasons why I became an elector to the Country Music Hall of Fame right away and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because you have to have had 25 years in the business. But I had 25 years in the business when I was 25. I mean, because my grandmother had a record shop and a jukebox chain, and I had grown up clerking in the record store. And she paid me in records from the jukebox chain, which I still have. And so I've been in the retail business pretty much all my life. I was the manager of a record store in St. Louis for a number of years. And so I came at it from the music end of it. My mother was a singer. I was a singer, you know, church.
What was it about music at an early age? Was it an escape for you? What excited you about it?
I was a loner. I was a kid who sat in his room and listened to 45 records on the record player and studied them, looked at them, who wrote the songs, who produced the records. You know, I was just always obsessed with records. For me, it's never been about concerts or stadiums or big things. It's about being alone with music and listening to records. That was my whole childhood.
Our journey starts with Lori Morgan and her son, Jesse Keith Whitley. You knew Keith Whitley personally. Why are they such an interesting pairing to start the journey?
I was at Lori Morgan and Keith Whitley's wedding. And I've known Lori forever. And I knew Keith when he first came to town, when he was married to his first wife. And we used to have them over here for spaghetti dinners. And I was such a fan. I thought he was a great, great singer. And as it turned out, a great writer, too. I didn't know it at the time. But there were a small group of us here in Nashville who knew him before he got a record deal. And all we could talk, we would go up and down Music Road. Have you heard? Have you heard? Have you heard him? Have you heard him? You know, trying to get something going for this kid because he was so talented. And so when he died, it was devastating to all of us and certainly to Lori. And to now with Jesse coming of age and becoming a musician, it's a fascinating full circle story.
All right. Well, let's get our stuff and head on out.
We're here at Lori Morgan's. Hey, girl.
Hey, Robert. I'm so happy to see you.
Likewise. It's been ages.
I know. So. But every time I see you, it's always like, uh-oh, what's coming?
I'm so pleased that this first episode of what we're calling our Nashville Sessions, that we're spending time with somebody, one of my favorite singers of all time.
Who's that?
Lori Morgan.
Oh, that's me.
And she's performed at the Opry since she's 13 years old. She's still a Grand Ole Opry member today. She's had hits like 5 Minutes, A Picture of Me Without You, Something in Red. I mean, there's like 20 top 10 hits. They're huge. She's a gold and platinum seller. And she's the daughter of a legend, a Country Music Hall of Fame member, George Morgan. And that's a real interesting story that we'll get to. And he died way too young. When you were just a kid. And her son is with us, Jesse Keith Whitley, who is the son of another famous singer.
That's
Keith
right.
Keith Whitley and Lori Morgan, who is another one of my favorites of all time. And thank you so much for joining me and my producer, Brad Newman, who's here.
My pleasure. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, well, let's start with George Morgan. I mean, he had Candy Kisses and all those great hits. What was he like as a dad?
Oh, as a dad, he's somebody that when I think of, I want to cry because I don't think there's ever been a better father to walk this earth. I mean, he just was amazing. He was funny.
He was funny.
Oh, he was hilarious. He had the best sense of humor. And every time I talk to people at the Opry, they're always like, oh my gosh, your dad was the greatest. He had the best sense of humor. And the ugly list that he had at the Grand Ole Opry.
pulled the gags on people all the time.
All the time. He would walk out and goose them on stage with drumsticks and just unplug their guitar. And just, he was just wanted to have fun.
He was a practical joker, and he used to torment Hank Williams.
Yes, he did, and Hank tormented my dad. Hank Williams got arrested in Texas. I think they found him sleeping in his car somewhere, and he was really, really drunk. And they pulled him out of the car, and they handcuffed him, took him down to this little county jail, little bitty jail in Texas, and they asked him what his name was, and he said, George Morgan.
That's good.
So Dad had to think of something good to get him back. I don't know what it was, but my dad was just, you always wanted to be around my dad. It was like, there's always going to be something fun to cook or something, you know, music, fun. It was just fun. He was the glue in our family.
Was he encouraging to you about doing music?
He was very encouraging to me, but he was not pushy. Mm-hmm. He didn't ever say, this is what I want you to do. He would say, whatever you want to do, I'm behind you. But when I decided that music was something I wanted to do, he was for sure the one who would say, don't you ever say, I can't, until you try it. If a producer asks you to sing a song in A and you know in your mind you probably can't do it, you try it. Mm. You always say, don't ever say, I can't. And he also told me this, too, that lives with me every time before I go on stage. He used to say, don't ever get too cocky before you walk out there on that stage, because you never know what can happen. Mm. Always be prepared that something could happen, because an artist will be able to handle it. He said, but if you're not prepared, if you think, oh, I'm invincible, and I'm the greatest, and nothing can go wrong, and all of a sudden, like me, I fall over a monitor on stage and show my derriere to the new record label.
Which you have done.
I have done, yes. So I remember those words.
I remember that.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
Well, who could forget?
I can never forget it, ever.
He brought you on the Opry when you were just, was it 13?
Mm-hmm, 13.
And you sang Paper Roses?
I sang Paper Roses. Uh-huh. And
were you good?
You know what? No, I was not. I don't know why. I sounded, and I have the tape somewhere in the archives, but I sounded like a little chipmunk singing. I mean, of course, I was just a child. And nowadays, when people... younger generation, they have these big loud voices and they're very trained, and mm-hmm. and I was not at all. I mean, and matter of fact, you know, I would sit around at the piano and sing to my dad and mom after dinner at night, and I learned the song First Time I Ever Saw Your Face, mm-hmm. By Roberta Flack. And my dad said, I want you to sing that on the Opry, and I'm like, Dad, I'm 13. I don't think that's a good song to sing. He said, okay, then pick something else out. But I want you to sing next week on the Opry. And I, at that point, had a stomachache for about a week. Mm-hmm. And finally, the big hit Marie Osmond had was Paper Roses. And I practiced Paper Roses and decided not to do the Roberta Flack song. And you know, it was weird because... I was so nervous, and still to this day when I go to the Opry, I get a little bit of a stomach twinge, like, what if I mess up, or what if I fall, or I always mm-hmm. have these doubts that what if they don't like me, you mm-hmm. know, and it makes me really nervous, and...
It's good to have butterflies, as long as they fly in formation.
Well, isn't it also a sort of reverence you have and hold for that place and what it means and what it meant for your daddy? And
yeah, and I didn't want to let my dad down because he was so proud and so excited about me singing that night. My mom was so nervous she couldn't come.
Really?
She had to listen on the radio. She told my dad, she said, I'll be listening from the restroom, okay? Just mm-hmm. let me listen from home.
And here she is right over there.
Yep.
She's got a picture of her right in the
beautiful
living room.
Beautiful mama.
Mm-hmm. And, how's she doing?
She's beautiful. Yeah. She's 85 and...
Still rocking?
Oh, yeah.
Hilarious.
Still, woo.
Jesse, do you know Candy Kisses?
I don't. She does.
I know. You used to sing it in your shows. Do you still mm-hmm. do it?
Yeah. I still do it.
Do it. It's George Morgan's biggest hit, and I, you know, give you the little flavor of what it sounds like. Just
right now.
Yeah.
I don't need the pick, so.
Oh, fine. I see how it is.
Candy kisses wrapped in paper mean more to you than any of mine. Candy kisses wrapped in paper you'd rather have them any old time.
Candy kisses wrapped in paper mean more to you than mine do, dear.
That's it. That's the song. Love that song. It's a classic. It really is.
Well, you know, when I
bet it never gets old.
And Dad told me that night at the opera, he said, now, as soon as I finish Candy Kisses, I'm going to look over at you. And if you feel like you can go on and sing, I want you to give me a nod. Yes, you know, I can come out, or you say no. I don't feel comfortable. So it was over, and he was talking, and that song ended, and I'm standing there, and he looked at me, and I just went.
You went right in between.
I was like, shrug my shoulders. I don't know what to feel. And so, long story short, he introduced me, and therefore, I've been there for 32 years as a member.
Did you feel any kind of pressure being in his shadow, or was it a blessing to be?
Both. Mm-hmm. Both. Being in Dad's shadow, it was big shoes to fill, because everybody loved Dad. Whether he was the biggest star on the stage at the time, it didn't matter. You wanted to be around him, and he was so just fun to be around, and everybody loved him in the music industry, and so that was one reason why when I knocked on the doors on Music Row, mm-hmm. people would let me in, because they loved Dad. It wasn't because I was the most talented person they'd ever heard. It was like, well, let's see what George's daughter wants. You know, we love George. Let's mm-hmm. bring her in. Bless her heart, kind of thing, yeah. You know? But that's how kind of I got to make my own friends with Dad's friends. You know, people like I'd sit down at Cedarwood Publishing Company till mm-hmm. wee hours of the morning with Webb Pierce and Joe Johnson and folks like that, and sing songs. And, you know, we don't have that in the music industry anymore. Mm-hmm. You don't get to jam with great writers and singers. And, you know, it was just a different time. So, but Dad, you know, that was a definite plus, him being who he was, opening doors for me. You know, unfortunately, it took me a lot longer to get a record deal, because new people would come to town, like Kathy Mattea, different mm-hmm. female Patti LuPone, people like that would come to town, and they were fresh, new faces, and I was just
like,
you've
been here all along.
Dirt, you know, oh, here, you know.
Oh, so, her again.
Yeah, oh, her again. The one that's on Ralph Emery 5 days a week, you know.
Was it a pressure for you, Jesse? I mean, it has to have been, living in the shadow, not of one, but two really great artists. Is it in your, you know, raising your hand up and going, hey, what about me?
Every day. Uh-huh. No, it's, I think they just kind of hold people like us kind of to a little bit of a higher standard, you know, and when they feel that that person has reached their, you know, their highest potential, that, you know, that is their time.
Mm-hmm. So it is a pressure. Yeah.
Of course.
It has to
absolutely
be.
It's like she said, you know, those are big shoes to fill, and I don't think anybody will fill either one of their shoes.
Yeah. Tell me about losing your dad at such a young age. That was not a good. He was only two.
Yeah, well, he remembers Keith.
You do? Mm-hmm. Really? I see.
A few little things here and there, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, you were only two when he died. That's kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm.
What is your first memory? What do you remember?
The drum thing, the little drummer boy drum thing, I remember that.
He had a drum he used to beat on, and Keith used to try and get him to do tempo, and he would sit on the floor.
And they had these little green sticks, I remember it. And yep. It had a green rope that tied around your neck, and yeah, I remember that. Just little things.
Yeah, but you also told me you remember Daddy giving you oatmeal. Every morning when Keith was home, he would feed Jesse.
Yeah.
But you remember feelings. You know, my parents divorced, and I remember the feelings that I had with my father. I didn't see him a lot when I was younger. But you remember, like, I remember some green baseball bat, you know, a big wiffle ball bat. But I remember that feeling of his visit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what's nice, that you at least have that feeling, because you know what that drum...
That's a good way to look at that. I never thought about it like that.
Well, you know, in the first time Jesse played with me on the Opry, he played drums.
Yep.
He played drums on Dear Me.
All right.
On the Opry.
Yep, and he wasn't scared at all until he got finished. His knees were just knocking. But he, you know what? He also, I don't know if he remembers it all the time, but I know he did it one time. He said, "Did I ever get on the bike with Dad, Daddy?" And Keith had a Harley.
Keith had a Harley, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he took him... as a baby in the front without a helmet.
Oh, smart.
Around the block on his Harley. And boy, I was mad. I can remember being so mad, but Jesse was just as proud as he could be sitting up there with that.
It runs in my blood. I've had mine too. I've had a few.
Mm-hmm.
So being orphaned, you know, by your dad, was that a really tough transition?
Traumatic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, your mom is a rock, but still.
I've often described it as a hole in your stomach that just never gets filled. It's just always empty. You just get used to it being there.
Mm-hmm.
If you concentrate on it, you'll notice how empty it is. But it's this hole that's always there, and you can never replace. You know, him and his presence and his... Dad had this certain cough that he had, just like a clear-in-his-throat kind of cough. And we'd be in school and morning mass, you know, and I could tell when Dad would come to mass, you'd just hear a little cough in the back of the...
Well, it runs in the family for sure. We did it with you, too.
They always knew I was there. But, yeah, it was so traumatic that... A lot of us in the family, not just me, my sisters, my brother, but his brother-in-laws, his sister-in-laws. I mean, we get together, and that's all we all talk about is Dad's stories.
Uh-huh.
He's just ever so present in everything we do, whether it's, you know, family reunions or just getting together. I mean, it's just, he's ever so present everywhere.
You did not break out of the gate into stardom by any means. I mean, you had a long climb up. Lots of failed singles, lots of tours, lots of TV. And I remember the time when you were out opening for George Jones that you almost wanted to drop out of the business.
I did drop out of the business.
Tell me about that.
I did.
Because George was such a horrible example?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was. I loved George. And let me say, for the record... that George was always nice to me. George was never anything but great to me. He loved my dad. He respected my dad. And he was just always a good man to me. Now, I've seen him treat other people absolutely terrible. And I was thinking, am I going to be next? You know, that right. kind of thing. But I was on the road with George, and it was in back when he was in his no-show Jones days.
He was a mess when you were on the road with him. He was a total mess. I remember. I went to one of those shows even.
A mess in what way?
He was drinking and drugging and everything.
He was rock-starring it.
he was terrible. I mean, we would prepare to leave on the road, and we'd get a call. Y'all just keep your bags packed. We don't know if we're gone. We can't find the possum, you know. And then we'd turn on the news, and he'd be arrested on the side of the interstate, mad. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was mad. He would hit the cameraman, and he was just terrible.
What demons was he fighting? Where was that coming from?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. What demons was George fighting? But he had a couple demons that lived with him all the time. It was the duck and the old man.
Well, and they talked in their voices. Yeah.
And one night I was on the bus by myself with George. The band had gone on, and they were supposed to do a few songs, and then they bring me on, and then they bring George on. So I'm sitting up in the front lounge in the front of the bus like this, and I look to the back, And there was a vent back in the stateroom door, and you could see George's feet, and he would cross them, and he'd uncross them, and he'd cross them back, and he'd get up. And then I heard him arguing with the duck.
It was a, he talked in this Donald Duck voice. It was schizophrenia.
Yeah, yeah, it was very serious. Mm-hmm. And then he would be the old man, the old lady.
Mm-hmm.
They both sounded kind of the same. And he was just absolutely out of his mind. And that night he came on stage. He got in my closet on the bus and got my light blue frilly poncho.
I don't know this part of the story.
It's hilarious. You know those light blue lizard boots he had?
Uh-huh.
They were beautiful. Mm-hmm. Nudie boots, mm-hmm, or something. Well, they matched that poncho perfectly. And so he was on the bus going through all this stuff, you know, and we were all on stage, and George walks out in my poncho with white flowers and lace and stuff, and the band just about dropped their teeth, and he came out, and he's saying, "I'm ragged, but I'm right," and that hair was flying all over. And then he said, "Good night, everybody," and we hit the deck because people started throwing bottles. I mean, they had to escort us out because George was just... I mean, so
yes,
that...
Yes, appreciate Lori was not a star at this point.
No.
She was just the chick singer on the show.
I was like 20, mm-hmm, 21 years old, and this was... not how my dad did it. So this was all new to me. I never saw my dad take a drink. I'm lying. Him and my mom would split a Heineken during the World Series. So,
woo,
yeah.
Party.
Yeah. So I never was used to any of that. And so when I got home, it was Biloxi, Mississippi was my last night with George. I flew home the next day, actually that night, when you could just walk in an airport, buy, mm-hmm, a ticket, and get on the plane.
Right.
And I left, and I went home, and I never looked back, and I said, I can't do this business. I was so upset that my esophagus was closed. I couldn't eat food. I could just, like, chew food and get juice,
mm-hmm,
and I'd have to, you know, get rid of my meat and whatever was... I mean, I lost like probably 15 pounds.
Well, if you look at George at that time and say, is that what this business does to you?
That's what I said. Yeah. I said, if this is what it does to me, and I don't want this. I don't want to be a part of this. I had a little girl already at home, my daughter Morgan. And I said, you know, when does it change? When am I going to wake up and go, oh, this is what I want to be? You know, I want to live this life. And I was afraid of it. So I got totally out. I lived with my mom, my daughter, for a while. And Ralph Emery called me and said, hey, we want you back on the morning show after about a year. And I contemplated it, you know, and I'm like, I don't know, Ralph. He said, you know, Lori, if you continue just not sing, you're never going to sing. So I started doing the Ralph Emery show,
mm-hmm,
three mornings a week.
How ironic that... Keith Whitley also had a terrible demon,
mm-hmm,
and that you had seen that once and now you saw it again. Was that terrifying? Or I know you tried your best to help him.
Yeah, Keith's demons were more hidden than George.
Yes, Keith Whitley was not a social drinker. Keith Whitley drank alone.
Alone.
I never saw him, mm-mm, drinking.
No.
Which is odd, and not to interrupt, but the idea is that I had never heard of that before, that someone would have dinner with you and maybe have nurse a beer and maybe not even finish it. But God forbid he goes to the bathroom in the middle and has a flask with him, he may empty the entire contents.
And come back a total different dude.
Right.
Exactly.
How strange was that?
It was very strange. I felt like a keeper of Keith. And I loved him so much that I, because when he drank and he got off on, we never fought. We never had.
No, he was actually funny a lot of the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good fun to be around, mm-hmm, but I mean, not for me because I knew.
You knew things that nobody else knew.
Yeah.
You know.
But I can remember Keith get. Keith went to Hazelden. Joe Galani sent him to Hazelden to rehab. And he was there for, what, like 6 weeks? Yeah, it was a long time. Mm-hmm. And he would call once a week and blah, 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 and tell me he was the leader of his, you know, little groups and stuff, and he was feeling good. And so the day came when we were supposed to go pick him up from the airport, and we called Joe Galani, head of RCA, to go with us, me and Jack McFadden, who was his manager. Mm-hmm. And we called Joe to go with us, and he couldn't make it. Joe had something really, really important he was doing. And so we're standing there at, I think it was Eastern Airlines, and we're standing at the gate, and Keith gets off the plane drunk from Hazelden. And I looked at Jack, and Jack looked at me, and we both just started crying. And Keith was like, "Hi, y'all doing?" You know? And we got home, and I opened his bag, and he had all those little airline bottles in his bag. And I said, "Keith, what are these?" He said, "Ha, those guys, they're always playing tricks." And I'm like,
"Yeah, right.
Whatever." So that night, I had to. Keith took Anabuse, so he wouldn't drink. Mm-hmm.
Which what does that do to you? Does it make you throw up if you?
Yeah, and it makes you violently sick.
It makes you very sick.
It's like an embalming stuff in it. You don't ever. I mean, when he was on it and regular, he would check with the airline. Like, we would fly, and he'd say, "Now, does this dessert have any kind of liqueur in it or whatever?" And they'd say, "Yes." And he'd say, "I can't eat it," because it would really affect his Anabuse. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, that I had to wait 24 hours. And then when we went to bed, I emptied all of his stuff, and I gave him an Anabuse, and I tied my robe belt to my leg and to Keith's leg so I could feel him in the night if he moved.
If he tried to get up and...
And drink. Mm-hmm. And he was pulling one time during the night, and he said, "Can't I just go to the bathroom by myself?" I said, "Nope, I'm going with you." And it was just the way it was. And, you know, it just, he was dealing with things that I know some of the things he was dealing with in his mind. I would never write about them. I would never talk about them. Because to Keith, they were sacred and they were his demons. I don't know all of them. But
you have to appreciate, we're talking about one of the greatest country singers ever. I mean, he, on top of all of this issues, he could deliver. I mean, he could sing like a bird.
And sing anything.
And write.
Sing, write, loved, you know, loved Lynyrd Skynyrd, loved Hank Williams, loved Mel Street, George Jones.
Would he sing to you in the house? Were you around that
brilliance? Yes.
Would you hear some of these songs for the first time?
Keith would sing to me all the time.
Give you goosebumps?
Time. He'd say, "Sit down, let me sing you what me and Don Cook wrote today." Or, you know.
You know what I love? There's a new kid in town.
Jesse just recorded New Kid in Town.
Ooh, can you do it, Jesse?
A little bit?
I think I can do a little bit.
Keith Whitley.
Keith
Whitley co-wrote this with Don Cook and... Putnam, Curly Putnam.
Curly Putnam. Are you sure? It's in D. Don't get it too low for you. Mom.
We're looking for a king, the new Messiah. We're following the stars, shining brighter. Oh man, won't you help us if you can? He shook his hand, but he pointed his hand. There's a new kid in town, and he's lying in a manger down the road. There's a new kid in town, but he's just another baby, I suppose. Heaven knows there's a new kid in town. here in Bethlehem.
Heaven knows there's a new kid in town here in Bethlehem.
Love that song.
Beautiful.
And Keith was very religious, too. He loved that kind of stuff. Robert, you're making me sad.
I know.
You're making me cry.
Me, too. I'm starting to tear up myself. Jesse, what do you worry about inheriting the bad part of Keith as well as the good part? You do sound like him.
No, not really. Mm-hmm. I kind of had that battle once or twice. But, no. I have a little bit of fun, but that's about it. You know.
The wake of Keith's death, your career had not taken off yet. You was just starting, mm-hmm. and now it became a necessity, right?
I had to make it.
You had to, because now Keith wasn't there, and you had at this point
two children
to support and no hits.
Right. Well, I was on the verge of my first one.
On the verge of your first hit, yeah.
On the verge of my first hit, and people had their own views of how long I should be in mourning.
Mm-hmm. You didn't have the luxury to be in mourning.
I didn't. I had to get out and work. And, did I want to? No, I wanted to lay in bed and be in a ball, you know, for ever. But the kids were there and, you know, they had school and baseball practices and, you know, basketball games and things like that. And I had to have and find the strength to go on and get on that bus and leave.
Does it ever strike you that now you have more hits than your dad ever did?
No.
You have. You've had more top 10 hits than George Morgan.
Wow.
So.
Bless his heart. And you know what's weird? My mom said the other night, we were talking, I said, Mom, can you believe I've been a member of the Opry for 32 years? She said, that's longer than your dad. He was 28 years. I said, oh, my God. Wow. You know, and when I think of how young he was.
Well, then you were, too.
When he passed away, though.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
51 or 52 years old, and I've, you know, surpassed that. And I'm thinking, he never had, you know, and Dad never had a bus.
No, not back then.
He traveled in a car, you know. A lot of his friends had buses and stuff, but not Dad. And I kept thinking, man, he would love to be out here with me in his little silk pajamas on my bus, you know, eating, smoking his Camel cigarettes, you know.
So some of that tragedy really gave you the kick in the pants to try to find your own voice, to really elevate your game, so to speak. When you say, is that where you found your voice?
Well, she could always sing. She was always... Oh, she just didn't have the hit song.
I didn't have the hit song, and I didn't have the belief in the business. The business looked at me as, oh, okay, Lori's going to sing. They didn't really believe that I could really do this, really sing.
Can you sing a song that was a turning point for people?
I had my capo, because...
I should have brought the Goldie.
Let's see. You borrowed my favorite dress. I borrowed your best perfume. And we're looking good, I guess. We've turned every head in the room. But the best thing I've ever seen is looking at you. And girl, I'd give anything to be in your shoes. 'Cause I'd love to be out of your shoes tonight. To be the one turning him on when he turns out the light. Under your skin, lying with him, when he holds you tight, I'd love to be out of your shoes tonight. tonight.
That's one of the good ones, isn't it?
And Jesse works for me on the road. He does my monitor, because as I told you, I'm getting old and I'm getting stupid. And I can't remember my words anymore. So he had the phone there going through them so I wouldn't forget my words.
Senility strikes.
But you know, that's right. But you know, Jesse's been working with me for a couple years and doing merchandise.
I've been running prompter for a lot longer than a couple years.
So Jesse, you're in the shadow of two legends. You know, does that make it tougher for you to get people to pay attention or respect you?
I think people expect to hear Keith Whitley, mm-hmm. is what, you know, they expect. And that's not going to happen. I mean, in our live shows, we do a lot of dad stuff. You know, we do When You Say Nothing At All, I'm Over You, Don't Close Your Eyes. You know, there's a couple that we'll pull out, you know, and do. But, you know, I kind of decided early on that I had to kind of make my own way and do mm-hmm. my own style, and my style is completely different. Not completely different,
yes,
but it's
pretty much.
It's
singing a slightly lower register for one thing, I think.
You know what? Mm-hmm. That's not the first time I've heard that. Mm-hmm. But I also can get up there pretty good too, and mm-hmm. we do we're a lot more southern rock, country.
So that's what your band is like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're pretty rocking.
But when you sing those songs like Don't Close Your Eyes, I listened to that, and it just had resonance for me because some of the words, and you're talking about this man that you miss, and it's weird because you must, I wonder if you ever channel your father a little bit within that, but also miss him.
Oh yeah. That.
I mean, it's a lot of stuff going on in that song.
When I did my Grand Ole Opry debut this year, it was pretty crazy. We,
I can't remember the date.
Well, I'd played the country classic show on the Ryman a few years ago, and just came out and did one song, and it was on May 9th, which was the day my dad passed away. So that was a pretty cool thing. Then I did my Opry debut this year, and it was...
I think it was last year.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, 2016.
And I'm still in 2016. And
I think we all are.
Well, we get there, and I was already, I was kind of nervous. And you know, like, for me, the Ryman is obviously the mother church, but I grew up backstage at the Grand Ole Opry House. So when I got to play the Grand Ole Opry, I was freaking out a little bit. And had my own dressing room and everything. I was right next to Mom, and go on. Mom goes on, and Mom was gonna bring me on her segment, and she gets done with her song, and it's storming really, really bad, like real bad. And it cut the power off. The signal to live radio went off.
Wow,
Keith.
And it was totally bad. And walked on and did I'm Over You, and it was
after the power came on.
Well, yeah, of course. Of course. And
what a night.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, actually. And then we came back on and did a Skynyrd song called Red, White, and Blue, and that was about the time with all the police officer killings and the, you know, everybody was kind of fighting the cops. And It was awesome. There's a picture right at the end of the song. I told everybody that if they had their cell phones, pull their light out. And there's a picture the whole place is lit up with cell phone lights. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like little fireflies all over the place. It was a good night.
That's neat.
Yeah, so after the storm, there was the light.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have to do a Keith Whitley song before we close this thing out.
Well, I know you loved him a long time ago. even now in my arms, you still want him, I know. But darling, this time your memories die when you hold me tonight. Don't close your eyes. Don't close your eyes. Let it be me. Don't pretend it's him in some fantasy. Darling, just once let yesterday go, and you'll find more love than you've ever known. Just hold me tight when you love me tonight, and don't close your eyes.
So good.
So good. Thank you, guys. Good.
Thank you guys. Thank you. So much.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
Before we close up this first episode, we want to share one more story. Here's a classic that Lori told us, which was too good to leave on the cutting room floor. It's a bonus track, something we're going to call the B-side, Stories from the Road. Once again, here's Lori Morgan describing an embarrassing moment that happened to her on tour.
So I'd been out on tour for a couple weeks. I'd been gone, and we were working at the Geo Theater in Opryland, when that we used to have the Great Opryland Nashville.
Yeah, the amusement park.
Yeah, the amusement park, and it was just a great place to play. And I had just switched labels. I was from RCA to B&A, and so the whole front row, there was like 20-some people from B&A had come to my Geo Theater show. And I was running out of clothes, seriously running out of clothes. My bus was in the back. My best girlfriend, Ruthie, was with me. And we were on the bus, and I said, what do I wear? And I had this beautiful silvery greenish kind of dark, I don't know, sage, chiffon and satin short dress and the shoes that match and beautiful dress. And I couldn't find any underwear on my bus. So we're looking in the drawers in my bus, and Ruth pulls out this pair of red thongs, and she said, here's some. And I said, something's better than nothing. So I stood up like this, and I'm in the light at the buses, the windows back here. I said, can you see through the dress at all? She said, no, it's perfect. It's perfect. So I go on, and I'm singing. It's at the beginning, middle of the show, and I just was messing with this guy in the audience, and I backed up, and it's when my guys were still on wedges. I backed up, and my legs hit the wedge right here. When I turned around, I fell over the wedge. My dress flipped up. My derriere is facing the audience with the red G-string, and I couldn't get up because my shoes were slick. And my band was just going.
They're just staring.
They could not believe, because, you know, I like pretty much have it together most of the time. So they're like, I mean, they were just, nobody came to help me. And finally, my sound guy ran out and helped me up. And the crowd, you could hear him going, oh, you know, it was just, and I got up and I said, well, I was looking for something in red. Now y'all know I found it. And that's all I could think to say. And it was my entrance to my new record label. And it was just terrible.
The best. The best. Well, thank you guys so much. This has been a blast.
You're welcome.
And it's always
Robert,
good to see you.
Always you. Always.
We've known each other a long time.
A long
Since
time.
Since before you were Lori
and
Morgan.
And Keith loved you.
Yes, we were big buddies.
He loved
we
you.
We were big buddies.
from the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to Fox News Podcast shows ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or follow wherever you get your podcasts.